Tiger!
Order, order.
Parliament resumes at 2 on Tuesday, back from a fortnight's adjournment that coincided with the school holidays. Tuesday will start as usual with a dozen questions for oral answer by ministers, and for what's likely to happen next, we must rely on the government's business statement on the Thursday before the adjournment began from its leader of the House.
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, next week the House begins a two-week recess where members of the House will be able to spend more time in their electorates and on select committee business. When the House resumes on Tuesday the 13th of October, the Government will progress a number of first readings on the order paper, including the Environment Canterbury Transitional Governments Arrangements Bill, the Taxation Transformation First Phase Simplification and Other Measures Bill, and the Health Home Carers Bill. Wednesday of that week, sir, will be a Members' Day.
And we'll be looking at two items on Mr Brownlee's business statement in this program.
Where members of the House will be able to spend more time in their electorates and on select committee business.
And there actually was a select committee meeting in the second week. The Finance and Expenditure Committee met here at Parliament to discuss a departmental report. Can't tell you any more than that, though, because the meeting was closed to the public. So once again, we had to take to the corridors, calling in on the Clerk of the House, David Wilson, for guidance on what happens following this week's agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPPA. I began by asking him if Parliament can make changes to a treaty.
Well, no, it can't directly do that. The signing of treaties and foreign affairs is really a prerogative of the executive. And in recent years, Parliament has had a role in scrutinising treaties before they come into force. But really, Parliament's role is to scrutinise, to draw to the attention of the House any problems it sees, but it doesn't have the ability to change a treaty. What it can do, though, is where treaties require legislation to implement them, it can certainly amend that legislation in any way that it likes.
How does it get to do that? Does the government then introduce legislation, or does it table the treaty? What happens? What's the process?
Well, there's quite a lengthy process for Parliament considering treaties. They are first presented to the House by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and they stand referred to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, which can either keep the treaty and look at it itself or allocate it to another committee, depending on the subject matter of the treaty. The committee has 15 sitting days, so 15 parliamentary days, to have a look at the treaty, and in that time, the government has agreed that it won't take any further action to implement the treaty. So that gives Parliament a bit of time to look at it. So the committee does that. When it reports to the House, it might identify any issues with the treaty that it wants to draw to its attention. Then the government is free to carry on with the implementation of the treaty, to respond to any recommendations made by the committee. And then if the treaty requires legislation to bring it into effect, as the recent one for the free trade agreement with South Korea did, then that's introduced to the House and proceeds like any other piece of legislation.
And what happens if the government fails to pass legislation implementing the treaty?
If it did that, and it simply wouldn't be able to implement the treaty. And I guess that would be part of a wider problem for a government that was unable to implement its legislative program.
Can the government introduce legislation to implement a treaty's obligations before the House has considered the committee's report on it?
It could do that, but the government's agreed that it will wait the 15 sitting days while the Select Committee looks at the treaty before it takes any further action. And that's a convention that's set out both in standing orders and in the Cabinet Manual. But there's nothing in law to stop it doing that, but it wouldn't benefit from the scrutiny of the Select Committee.
So when the treaty is with the Select Committee, does the public get a chance to make submissions?
Yes, the it's up to the Select Committee, as it is with all of the business that comes before committees, whether or not to call for public submissions. They have done in the case of some treaties that have been referred to them, and the recent free trade agreement with South Korea was an example, where they received a small number of public submissions and heard some of those. So it's certainly free to do that. The limiting factor is the fact that it only has 15 sitting days to consider it, and so the time for making submissions is usually quite short.
With the South Korea treaty, did that result in any amendment to an act?
Yes, there was an amendment to the Tariff Act 1988 to change some of the tariff limits to give effect to the Free Trade Agreement.
Prior to 1998, this process didn't exist, did it? It was the government could just sign a treaty with a foreign power and Parliament didn't have any say at all. What led to the government relinquishing this control over its own actions?
Well, you're right. Prior to 1998, there was no role for Parliament in considering or approving treaties at all. So for a few years prior to that, it was felt that that arrangement was not satisfactory. And in 1996, the Clerk of the House, David McGee, prepared a paper suggesting changes and a role for Parliament in scrutinising treaties. That was picked up a couple of years later by the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee in an inquiry they did into Parliament's role with treaties, and they recommended that it play the role that it currently does, have the opportunity to scrutinise treaties for a short period of time. That proposal was picked up by Parliament in 1998, and they experimented by making what's called a sessional order, so a temporary change to Parliament's rules to try this process out and see how it worked. Parties generally felt it was successful, and so the next change of standing orders for 1999, that was adopted and became part of the rules of the House. And since that time, that process has applied to all of the treaties that have been referred by the government to Parliament.
When the government tables a treaty in the House, there's a national interest analysis. Who prepares that and what is it for?
Well, that's prepared by government officials as part of this process for the Parliament to consider treaties. And it sets out the case for and against the treaty, the obligations that it creates, the effects of the treaty, any costs involved, any compliance costs in implementing the treaty, and the consultation process that has gone through. It also sets out whether there are any provisions to withdraw from the treaty at a later stage. So the idea with that is to give the select committee that's considering it and the public who might be interested or who might want to make a submission the opportunity to have some information which otherwise wouldn't be available to them, and the text of the treaty by itself isn't likely to be so informative to the public. So the national interest analysis is a requirement of standing orders and is something that the committee will append to its report as well. So it's considered really the primary document for the public to have information about the effects of a treaty.
The Clerk of the House, David Wilson. Leaving his office, we move up the corridor and round the corner to the Bills office, prompted by this item off the agenda for the week ahead from Gerry Brownlee's business statement.
Wednesday, sir, will be a Members' Day.
And as Rhys Lyon discovered at the Bills office, among the first readings on Wednesday night's order paper is a Members' Bill aimed across the chamber from one member to another.
A bill near the top of the members' order paper is one in the name of Labour's Titai Hararo MP, Adrian Ruafe, which seeks to bring parliamentary undersecretaries into the scope of the Official Information Act, or OIA. The Official Information Parliamentary Undersecretaries Amendment Bill would ensure that information held by parliamentary undersecretaries in their official capacity can be subject to requests under the Official Information Act 1982. There's been provision for the appointment of parliamentary undersecretaries since 1936, a role most recently enshrined in the Constitution Act of 1986. There's only one in the current parliament, and that's ACT Party leader David Seymour. I spoke to him about his take on the bill and asked him to begin by explaining his role as a parliamentary undersecretary.
Well, my role is that I am assigned specific duties by the ministers, in my case the Minister for Regulatory Reform and the Minister for Education. I am a parliamentary undersecretary to those ministers, and each of them have assigned me different duties. So in each of those areas I do not make decisions, but what I do is come up with proposals upon which the relevant minister decides.
And so how would your role as a parliamentary undersecretary differ from that of an associate minister?
Well, an associate minister can actually sign off and make decisions, whereas as an undersecretary, when reports come through from the department, generally the instruction for the undersecretary is to note, whereas the instructions for the minister is often decide or approve.
And you're the only MP with the title of Parliamentary Undersecretary at present, is that right?
That's correct, but I'm far from the first. Bill English, the Deputy Prime Minister, first entered the Executive as an Undersecretary, and I think it's relevant to this particular discussion that the Labour Party has made use of this position in the past. Most recently, I understand Helen Clark appointed Dover Samuels as an Under-Secretary. It's actually a position that's existed in the Constitution Act since 1986.
Parliamentary Under-Secretaries are not subject to the OIA and also aren't subject to questions and question time. Do you think they should be?
I'm in two minds. In one sense, I couldn't care less because I already behave as though I'm subject to the OIA, which is a prudent way for anyone to behave as in politics, is to assume that what you do could end up on the front page of the paper. And what's more, anything I do that ultimately becomes official and leads to a ministerial decision has to go through the minister's office and is therefore subject to the OIA. So in one sense, it would not make a significant difference to me. In fact, probably no practical difference if under-secretaries were subject to the OIA. However, there does need to be some proportion in the law. And I think the question that the proponents of this bill have to ask themselves is if you have no ultimate decision-making ability and if documents and transactions you undertake that do lead to ministerial decisions by the executive are already subject to the OIA through the minister, then what exactly is the purpose of this legislation? If it's so important, why did the Labor Party not do this when they had under-secretaries in their government? And I suspect what you see here is a junior member of the Labor Party. I think Adrian Ruafe is a first-timer in Parliament, and he's probably been given a bill that he doesn't really understand or believe in himself, but somebody in the Labor caucus had to put it in the ballot, through the luck of the angels, he's had this particular bill drawn.
Would you see some benefit, though, in being able to be subjected to questions and question time?
Well, I'm able to answer questions on behalf of the minister by choice, but I'm not required to answer questions. And the truth is that it's been controversial in the House, as you'll know, but from time to time, people do actually transfer questions. The Prime Minister sometimes transfers questions to other ministers, for instance. So it's actually hard to say that anybody is especially required to answer a question. But hypothetically, were I to be forced to answer questions on my undersecretarial work in Parliament, I would have to give the answer that this is the advice I formulated for a minister, but I can't actually be held to account for the final decision because I don't make the final decision. So I think while it's probably not a bad political stunt for the Labor Party to put a bill like this in, once you start to work through the practicalities of what it would mean, you find that there's a lot of hot air and not much substance.
You probably already indicated the answer to the next question, but have you been approached by Adrian Ruafe and would you vote in favour of the bill?
I've never been approached by him. As I've said, I'm pretty ambivalent, but simply for the reasons of the practicalities of actually what it would mean, the importance of the information that would be uncovered, given that there's no final decision-making power, given that truly official information I handle has to end up in the minister's office so he or she can make a decision, and given that there has to be some proportionality in the law. Is this law proportional for the costs it imposes to the benefits it derives? Probably not, so I'd vote against it.
ACT MP for Epsom, David Seymour. And Adrian Ruafe's bill is the third on the members' order paper, behind Phil Goff's Education Charter Schools Curriculum Amendment Bill and Carmel Cipollone's Social Workers Registration Mandatory Registration Amendment Bill.
Rhys Lyon, Parliament resumes at 2 on Tuesday for a two-week sitting period that goes through to October the 22nd. More details on our website, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Tom Frewen, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.